Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 35. I'm Michael Shoebridge from Strategic Analysis Australia, and I'm joined by SAA's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael.
Marcus, welcome back from your deployment.
Thank you. Yes, I've just gotten back from a few days up in northern New South Wales with the men and women of the New South Wales Rural Fire Service doing a bit of flood response.
This is responding to Alfred, wasn't it?
It was responding to Alfred. And I note the ADF has also responded to Alfred, which is a little interesting because the Defence Strategic Review said that's not the kind of thing the ADF should be doing, and the government seemed to agree that it probably wasn't the sort of thing the ADF should be doing, and yet here we are.
The Prime Minister accepted that recommendation out of defence that the military is too busy doing warfighting stuff, so shouldn't be called upon for disaster relief, except in the most extreme circumstances. But the first thing he did before the first drop of rain fell was call out the ADF to help out with Cyclone Alfred.
Yes, I think this is one of those cases of the more things change, the more they stay the same. And it's that issue of the federal government doesn't have a fire brigade, doesn't have an emergency service. It doesn't really have anything to show it's putting boots on the ground, except for the ADF. So it can spend money, it can change the law, but however, it doesn't really have anything that has a physical presence rather than the ADF.
Well, at the time when the government accepted this, I think, ridiculous recommendation that the military shouldn't do anything for disaster relief, other people should, there was this magical other people. Of course, other people are people like you who turn up all the time anyway, and they're not paid like the military to turn up. But to build more capacity in the other response arms of government, state and federal, you'd need to spend real money, billions of dollars, on these others.
Mm.
And the government, both state and federal governments, are not doing that. So of course they'll keep calling on the ADF. I mean, I'm glad that Cyclone Alfred wasn't as destructive as we feared, so I'm glad that there was a more limited response. I feel for the people who have suffered damage to their businesses and homes and lives. But during the lead-up to Alfred, I was listening to the radio, and I heard a Defence Force recruiting ad with this lovely young lady who was in the military, and went something like this. There was smoke and fire everywhere. People were scared and worried, and we were there to help. We saved them. And I'd do that again, quick as a flash.
And was this smoke and fire from an enemy's bombing raid?
No, it was a bushfire, and she said...
Disaster response.
Yes, she went on to say, I'd do that again if I got the chance, because this is why I joined the Australian Defence Force.
Okay, so even though it's not the purpose of the Australian Defence Force, and it's not really something they apparently should not be doing in the first place, it's the sales pitch from the Australian Defence Force to young Australians.
Yes, so the left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing.
I think it's just another example of defence can imagine a perfect world as much as it likes, whether it is a world in which it doesn't have to do disaster response or a world where we will, quote, never fight alone. Reality is going to come along.
Yep.
And you can't change or wish away reality.
Well, I wonder, imagine that perfect reality for the military, that they don't do disaster relief. So Cyclone Alfred hits, it is really destructive. But for the ADF, they stay in their barracks. So the army stays in Anogra Barracks in Brisbane, and they have mornos, and they do sportos, and maybe have a bit of a jog around and over.
And they wait for the SES to come along and clear the gate.
Well, so they look outside. They look outside the gate.
Go to Shoalwater Bay.
And if there's destruction everywhere, wailing children and trees down blocking roads, they put a call through to the Queensland government demanding to have the road cleared because they've got to get to their exercise area at Shoalwater Bay. So success for the ADF, not helping with disaster relief, would be incredibly corrosive brand damage to their reputation. Yeah. So I hope that they aren't a victim of that Chinese curse, may you get everything you wish for, because it would be an enormous own goal.
Look, I just can't see it ever happening, that we would have all of these resources to do disaster response and they're just going to sit there doing nothing. So there was some good news this week, Michael.
Oh, yes.
Yes, and it's good to see that the Australian government is showing some spine and that we're not going to let ourselves be pushed around by American bullies anymore, and we are actually pushing back on American bad behaviour.
Well, that's good. We've got a lot of leverage. We have incredibly valuable imports that we're buying from America. So we're probably saying we're looking elsewhere. We're going to Airbus, not Boeing.
Sorry, what? No, I'm not talking about tariffs, Michael. I'm not talking about tariffs. I'm talking about the wombat snatcher.
Oh.
Sam Jones.
Oh.
Yes. I mean, that's the big news. This American dares to come to Australia and manhandle or womanhandle innocent Australian wombats. We're not going to stand for that, and I'm glad to see that the Australian government is pushing back on this bad behaviour.
Well, look, this wouldn't...
The Prime Minister himself, he said, well, you can do that with a wombat, but he said, take a baby crocodile from its mother and see how you go there. Well, I'll put aside the fact that female mother crocodiles don't actually look after their babies, but he's sending the right message. Tony Burke, Minister for Home Affairs, who's protecting our borders, said, if she ever applies for a visa again, I'll be surprised if she even bothers. I can't wait for Australia to see the back of this individual. I don't expect she will return.
Well, yeah. I would just point out both the Prime Minister and Tony Burke made these strong, very strong remarks, refreshingly strong, after the young lady had already left the country. So in that way, the horse had bolted in a way.
So, but look, it's good to see. I mean, a lot of unkind people have said Prime Minister and the government haven't shown any spine in standing up to America
since
Donald Trump was inaugurated. But clear evidence of spine.
Well, look, I think it will be received in the Trump administration, probably with a little bit of consternation, because it is an extremely powerful but subtle, and to use a term beloved of our Department of Foreign Affairs, nuanced approach to the Trump administration. I mean, it's much better than just being craven. And, you know, when we see Ukraine being blackmailed to try and get hold of their natural wealth by forcing the Ukrainians to sign a critical minerals deal, it's nice to see that our government wouldn't just offer up our own critical minerals for nothing to show how much we love the Americans.
It's good to see us getting ahead of the curve on the sycophancy scale.
Well, you can't be coerced if you've already agreed, can you?
If we've already handed over our critical minerals to the US. Yeah, so I find the whole thing a little perplexing, I have to say. It's because the US is putting tariffs on our steel and aluminium exports to the US, we're going to somehow avoid that by handing over our critical minerals.
Well, logic. I do have a Bachelor of Economics from the University of Sydney. I can bring that to bear here. Now, the simple analysis here is this is a masterful move, because if we have handed over our critical minerals for free, then the price is zero. And if the worst happens and the Americans do what they're doing to French champagne and put a 200% tariff on our critical minerals, 200%
of zero, nothing is nothing.
So
we are immune.
This is the way to handle these tariffs.
Oh, look, you know, a lot of people say
you get the certainty. That's all businesses and markets want, certainty. If we were to do the same with Australian aluminium and steel exports to the US, reduce the price to zero, we've got a tariff exemption right there.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, to me, that is the path that the Albanese government is on. Well, and I think it is masterful. And it's just a pity that the mainstream media has not picked up on
mainstream
this.
Mainstream media. Well, a lot of people say Trump is playing four-dimensional chess. I mean, it's pretty clear Albo's playing five-dimensional Mahjong.
I think he might have gone into the
six-dimensional Go.
Because Kevin Rudd, he did try to tell people this was our plan, because he'd presented this critical mineral deal to Lutnick, the guy, Commerce Secretary, administering the exemptions. But unfortunately, our ambassador said it's really hard to negotiate with someone who doesn't want anything.
So this was one of the other hilarious aspects, is that because the US were bullied, we offered up our critical minerals. They said we're not interested, so we sort of crawled back and said, are you sure?
Well, there'll be another time we can offer these for free.
Anyway, look, we may be suggesting here that we lack spine, but it's clear from the Sam Jones wombat monstering episode that we are growing some spine.
That young lady has got the message loud and clear. If she's receiving press releases from the Prime Minister's office and the Minister for Immigrations, and I have no doubt that she is.
All right, moving along. So we did talk about American bad behavior, and a lot of countries in the world are at the receiving end of American bad behavior. In fact, Canada, a country which has a special relationship with the US, going back a very long time, long-standing partner, fought many wars with the US, huge trade partner.
Well, an integrated economy. The Northern American economy is one integrated economy.
Well,
it's much closer even than Australia. Australia and New Zealand.
Well, Donald Trump wants to make it even more integrated by integrating Canada into the US as a 51st state. And not only did he just say this as a sort of thought bubble, he keeps coming back to it. So this is the situation where we've gotten ourselves into, where our alliance partner is actually talking about annexing its neighbours. So this has raised a bit of consternation in the broader national security community, and some people are saying, gosh, we need a plan B here. Whether it's a plan B for the alliance or a plan B for AUKUS as a subset.
Plan A is just doing what we're doing. Doing what we're doing and just hoping it'll be okay. So yeah. That's plan A. Yeah.
So a lot of talk about plan B, but there's sort of now this kind of counter plan B movement out there. And so we're sort of seeing a lot of
people. Is that an anti-B?
An anti-B. Yeah. a lot of people going, trying to be the adults in the room.
Yes, yes.
One might say a little pompously, saying, what? No, don't overreact. All this talk of a plan B is nonsense. The US is a long-standing partner. Mm-hmm. We have shed blood together.
Mm-hmm. You know,
we are long-standing trading partners. Yeah. Now, one might say that is exactly the situation with Canada, but let's just put that aside. We don't need a plan B because plan A is all fine.
It's rock
AUKUS,
solid.
It's all going to happen.
Solid.
No evidence to suggest AUKUS is not going to happen.
Only the nervous Nellies would think about it. Yep.
So let's be serious here. Let's be the adults in the room.
Yep.
Now, I think we should have a little talk about what actually do we mean by plan B? Because I think part of the issue here is people are talking past each other on what they mean by plan B.
Well, is plan B just doing more of plan A? Because I don't know about you, but I think when everyone else is running screaming from Washington, we should take our opportunity to run as fast as we can towards them. That, again, is, I think, the masterful genius of offering up our critical minerals. That's right.
So
it's a counter-market play.
Hmm. Well, when I think of plan Bs, I think there's sort of three different ways people talk about it. So one is something, you stop doing plan A and you do something fundamentally different.
Which is why
so
it's called
kill plan
B.
A and move on to plan B.
Yep.
Then there's the, well, plan B is something you do alongside plan A. So it's your risk mitigation strategy.
But you do it in parallel.
Like, that you do in parallel.
Imagine I had aging conventional submarines and I wanted to get nuclear submarines, but both things were risky. I might do something different. Like I might get a long-range strike or surveillance platform that wasn't a submarine. But that wouldn't mean I didn't stop looking after my old one or try to get the new submarine, but I'd have a plan B that I'd do at the same time.
Hypothetically speaking, B-21s as a long-range strike platform, or you go to the other end of the size, cost, complexity spectrum and you get Australian-made, large, uncrewed underwater vessels.
So
hypothetically
that would be a plan B you would do in parallel with your plan A.
Yeah, so you are hedging your risks. And then there's the third definition of plan B, which is you prepare something and you put it on the shelf. It's your break glass in case of emergency plan, in case plan A actually falls over.
It's your second getaway car in case your first one breaks down. And for those of us that have been involved in robberies or any kind of activity of that sort.
Well, we don't need to know about your murky background, Michael. The problem with that form of plan B is if your getaway car is broken down, the cops have probably got you already.
That happened. Yeah, that is exactly what happened.
You enjoyed your time in the slammer. But anyway, the problem with that kind of plan B is it's probably too late. So if we get to 2032 and we don't get SSNs, Virginia-class SSNs,
yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's a bit too late to go, maybe we should be doing something else.
If you actually want a plan B, you need to start enacting that plan B, not just thinking about what it might be should you need it later on.
Yes.
Yeah.
So when I read some of these pieces put out by the defenders of plan A, so the serious adults in the room who go, gosh, let's not get carried away. Just because Trump is threatening to annex Canada
and
sell out Ukraine
and maybe leave NATO.
Yeah. Don't get too carried away by that stuff, because the US is a long, reliable partner of Australia. And there's no evidence to suggest it's not a reliable partner.
Isn't there?
Other than wanting to annex its neighbours.
Well, look, I think if you just discount the evidence that we're seeing, there is no other evidence.
Yeah, if you ignore the evidence, there's no evidence.
Yes, and it hasn't actually applied in a particular specific way to us. It's just America's European allies, the partner that they are have been supporting in a war for that partner's existence, and their closest ally and neighbour.
And largest trade partner.
And largest trade partner. It's only them so far.
So, but these people who are the adults in the room, when they say, we don't really need a plan B, when you actually read what they write and you manage to get all the way through to the end, they do actually seem to say things like that, but we do need to be hedging our risks and we do need to be doing other things as well. And we do need to make sure we don't put all of our eggs in one basket. So what you're actually saying is we do need multiple plan Bs.
And we need them now.
Well, and we need them now.
I think it's really simple, isn't it? So America is either unreliable or has become more demanding. An unreliable America means that Australia and all other American allies and partners now need to be able to do things for our own security.
Do you mean like spend 3% of GDP?
Yes. So if America's unreliable, we need to do more in our own defence.
Yes.
If America has become more demanding
and wants us to spend 3%
then
of GDP,
we need to be able to do more for ourselves.
Yeah.
So we need a plan B now, whichever of those Americas we're dealing with. So to me, this is all a nonsense argument. All
yes.
these people huffing about, desperately trying to believe nothing's changed and saying, I take a long-term view. Well, Lord Keynes, the famous economist, he said, in the long term, everything's fine. But in the long term, we're all dead. So that's an empty thing. And then when you boil it down, all of the rest of them, there are very few people, maybe Paul Keating and Bob Carr, saying declare unilateral security independence and pretend America isn't there anymore. But everything in the Australian Defence Force's inventory ties back to an American company or supply system. So we can't just magically free ourselves of that. However, there's a lot we could do for ourselves.
Well, one of the things about the pompous adult in the room argument that we shouldn't abandon Plan A, so AUKUS
or
the alliance. Nobody in either major party
is even suggesting it. Yeah,
I mean they're actually terrified of that prospect.
Yes.
They are not suggesting it, so it is a total straw man argument. I mean, okay, the Greens are not fans of AUKUS. Are they ever going to hold power? Well, not certainly in my lifetime. I think
Bob Carr's time in power ended a while ago.
The people who are suggesting we should be getting French nuclear powered submarines, nobody in either major party is suggesting that. So it is a total straw man argument.
So actually, everybody that matters agrees we should have a plan B. Because it's either we have to do more for ourselves because America is unreliable, or we have to do more for ourselves because America is demanding that. So to me, the real discussion should be, and what should be in that plan B? And for those that haven't already purchased several copies of our book, No Higher Purpose has some of those answers. But it does get you, this whole discussion about the Americans gets you to where the Portuguese and a bunch of Europeans have got to, which is, can you rely on American defence technology, or will the Americans hit the off button?
Kill switch, the mythical F-35 kill switch. So, yes, there's been discussion about, well, can the US just turn off F-35s? And the general response seems to be, well, no, there's not a kill switch per se.
It's not labelled.
There may be hidden software. I don't know. I don't have access to the F-35 source code.
I don't think there has to be a kill switch.
No, that's the thing. Is like, okay, so nobody involved in the F-35 program actually has their own spares. All of the spares are managed centrally at a kind of program level. Most of it held by the US, but there are meant to be warehouses in other countries. All of those spares are owned essentially cooperatively.
Or by Lockheed Martin, the producer.
Yeah, they're actually owned.
So there's
it's
a
managed
pool,
by
isn't
Lockheed
it? It's,
Martin.
It's a global pool of spares.
On behalf of the global users. So we're going to run out of spares really, really quick if the US says you're not getting any spares. And F-35 is no different from many other US systems. I'm not sure how long we can keep using our Super Hornets and Growlers for without US support.
Or even Wedgetail. Everything that has American technology on it ties back to an American supply chain. And think about us even giving our old Abrams tanks to Ukraine in an epochal speed. The US gets a vote on that too, because they have to agree to the end user transfer documentation. So there may not be one magical kill switch, but if an American government doesn't want the user of an American military system to use that system, they have any number of fingers in the pie, and they can turn off software support, they can turn off spares and logistics support, or they can just say no to any of the myriad permits you need. So,
or weapons.
Yeah.
You know, if there's, you run out of the weapons that have been integrated onto it, then it doesn't matter how many other weapons you've got if they're not integrated.
It seems to me, with the risk already that the US can't produce enough, so even if they don't want to stop you using their stuff, you can't get enough of it when you need it. A plan B has to start somewhere, and a plan B is having things that aren't dependent on America that our military can use. And everyone will say, well, that's impossible because we're in too deep. But the answer there is, well, you've got to start somewhere.
The Ukrainians started
somewhere. They're now 30% self-sufficient on defence, and they've got another massive set of diversified suppliers in the form of the Europeans.
Yeah.
So it's not like they won't stop fighting if America pulls the plug. They're just better off if America doesn't pull the plug.
Look, and you're never going to be 100% self-sufficient. That doesn't mean you shouldn't try to be more self-sufficient than you are already. So, yeah, the problem with the Plan B issue is we are so dependent on the US. And when you look around the world and you go, well, maybe we should get stuff from the Europeans. Well, guess what? You know, they're going, holy crap, we need stuff quickly. So all their stuff is spoken for. So there's not a lot of options there. The Koreans might give us stuff. We've spoken about the Japanese, but guess what? The Japanese and the Koreans are now facing that same challenge with Donald Trump's rather erratic foreign policy.
I think they are doing the Plan B. They're doing more for themselves because they know it's the smart thing to do in the circumstance.
Yeah. So there is more we can be doing. And there are many examples of small to middle-sized economies that have actually grown capable defence industries. Yes. Turkey's been in the news a lot recently, and they're not just making simple things, they're making fighter planes.
They're making fighter planes now too. Yeah.
They're doing difficult stuff. Yep. The Swedes are doing difficult stuff. The Israelis are doing difficult stuff. The South Koreans are doing difficult stuff.
Yeah, but apart from Ukraine, Israel, South Korea, Norway, Turkey, Finland, apart from those countries, and Vietnam does quite a good job as well, and Japan, apart from those isolated examples, again, as the AUKUS grifters say, there is no evidence that a small actor can do more for themselves. You know what I predict, though? I do predict that what we'll see offered up as advice from the wise owls in our national security outfits, particularly the defence organisation, and embraced by the government, is this will be our moment to double down even more on America.
Oh, yeah. So when recently the opposition said, well, if they get into power, we'll get that missing fourth squadron of F-35s. Well, maybe a good idea, maybe not. But the problem is that we've already gotten our first 72. If we want more, we go to the back of the queue. There's now the original 8 members of the JSF consortium. There's now 20 countries using it, and there's around 2,000 aircraft.
So you'd be waiting a long time.
However,
there's some good news.
Good news. Countries like Portugal and, surprise, surprise, Canada are going, we might reconsider our JSF orders. So maybe some slots will open up. But I do think that if we're talking Plan Bs, the most fundamental question you need to be asking yourself is, do you want to be doubling down on that reliance on US systems, or do we want to start that long, slow path of building greater defence self-reliance and a stronger defence industrial
base? Look, it will be a long path, but some of it can be done quickly, because we've talked about this many times. The small, the smart, and the many can be in the Australian Defence Force's inventory very quickly. So yes, take a long time to get to the 30% of the Ukrainian self-sufficiency, but we could make some major steps very, very quickly.
Yes.
But I really do think that the Australian government's most likely policy response to an unreliable America is that TV show title from the ABC, I think, Please Love Me. It's just to offer more than they could possibly ask at a lower and lower price than they could possibly want, until eventually they grudgingly accept our affection.
Well, we will never fight alone, Michael. We will never fight alone.
Well, hope isn't a method, but maybe it could be.
All right, so coming up next week, it's the best night out of the year. It's when I get locked in Parliament House for the budget lockup. We're a week away.
That is not a night out. That's a night in. It's just a night in with a bunch of people poring over portfolio budget statement documents being duchessed by people like Jim Chalmers.
Well, no, it is a night out because it gets me out of the bunker, the SAA bunker, deep beneath the Brindabellas, because you actually have to go into Parliament House to get the budget.
That hurts. We have spent a lot of time and a lot of effort decorating this bunker and getting the air recycling just right. And to find, you see it as some kind of prison cell just because it is buried deep into the rock of the Brindabellas. That hurts.
So I'm going from one underground bunker to another called Parliament House. So we are going to get a budget. I'm not super confident there's going to be any fundamental change to the funding line that we have seen already.
Well, it's an opportunity for an Australian government to get ahead of the blackmail and also to enact the please love me by saying, you know, all those other naughty people that haven't been doing the right thing? Well, look at us. We down in Australia have done the right thing before you even yelled at us and increased the defence budget to 3%. But I don't think that's going to happen because I think this budget so far has been all about how do we bribe chunks of the Australian voting population? Mm-hmm. And there just aren't enough votes in bribing people on defence.
No, and I think the government's line has been made pretty clear. So we keep hearing this record spending line, record increases over the forward estimates. And it's like, well, yeah, but when we live in an age of inflation and the defence budget goes up every year...
By less than inflation.
Well, no, but whether it's less or more, but every year it's just going up. That's just what happens. Mm. By definition, every budget year is going to be a record one. Every forward estimates is going to be a record one. That is just the nature of the beast.
It just gets bigger.
If it's not a record... You're going backwards.
Just gets bigglier every year.
It gets bigglier every
year. Yeah.
So just like the massive salary that you pay me gets bigglier
every year. Well, it needs to get bigglier because there's nothing but pressures inside the defence budget. So the workforce... It's costing more to have less people. So if you get more people, it'll cost even more. Things like hearing about the Collins class life of type extension apparently looking really complex and risky. Well, that complex and risky are two synonyms for really expensive. Same across the whole of the ADF. So operating and maintaining stuff is going up. The cost of the workforce is going up. And the cost of all the new shiny things that defence wants was already eye-wateringly expensive and is going up. So there's nothing but pressure there.
No. So if we cast our minds back to the National Defence Strategy that came out last year...
I'm looking forward to the new one. It's due out soon.
Yeah. So the government said $5.7 billion new dollars in addition to the White Paper 2016 funding line, which had growth built into it, but $5.7 billion over the forward estimates, which is a record increase, apparently.
Mainly in the fourth year.
This financial year, so 24-25, of that $5.7 billion, there was a grand total of $400 million. That was the only increase to the defence budget beyond the White Paper 16 funding line.
You say $400 million. I like to talk in billions. $0.4 billion.
$0.4 billion.
It's a biglier number.
Unfortunately, when we look at all of the erosion that's been chipping away at the defence budget, that far outweighs that $0.4 billion. So we know the Red Spice program, big transfer within the defence
to
portfolio,
the Signals Directorate,
but coming out of the Department of Defence, so moving from ships and planes and tanks to cyber stuff, that's $1 billion a year. So even that $400 million doesn't compensate. Then when we look at inflation, the impact's probably in the order of about $4 to $5 billion a year in buying power. So despite all the talk about record spending, we're actually going backwards.
Through erosion to the defence budget. I'd just like to clarify, you're not claiming that this erosion of the defence budget is human-induced or man-made, are you? I mean, this is just a natural process that's operated over past epochs of defence time.
It's geology at work, Michael.
Yeah. Otherwise, it's the erosion hoax.
So my sense is we will not see significant new money in the budget. I'd be very happy to be proven wrong. If I walk into the Parliament House bunker, get the budget papers, and there's a whole bunch more new money there, I'll be pleasantly surprised. But the whole narrative coming out of the government is nothing there, and we should be grateful with the increases that are in there already.
Well, there's another narrative, isn't there? This is being called a car key election because we had the three Chinese warships turn up. But I think even bigger news is...
Sorry, they car key. I thought they were great.
No, but the car key bit I'm getting to, if you'll just let me get there. Mr. Albanese going so big and so strong on Ukraine, saying that Australia will consider a proposal proposal of very strong words to participate in peacekeeping in Ukraine. He's been working closely with the UK's Keir Starmer. They've had a couple of chats. The idea that we might now, what we might do is become clearer. A small contribution commensurate with the size of our defence force?
Almost vanishingly small. So a couple of points on this. First one is you can't have peacekeepers until there's peace. And Donald Trump's attempt to end the conflict within a day has kind of sort of blown out. And his strategy of kind of sucking up to Putin, pressuring Zelensky, doesn't seem to have worked that well, because Mr. Putin has gone, your first negotiating ploy was to absolutely roll over. Well, why don't I just play, see what I can get? If I play a little hardball, because you gave me everything I wanted and more before I even started negotiating.
I'm going to go out on a limb here, Marcus. I'm starting to feel that Vladimir Putin isn't interested in a peace unless it gives him even more than he planned to get at the start of this war. I'm starting to think he may not be ready for a peace that looks at all like a peace. I don't know.
Well, the trouble with peace negotiations is generally both sides need to want peace. And there's really no indication that Vladimir Putin wants peace.
If I was Putin and I watched Donald Trump weakening my opponent by withdrawing military support and browbeating them and putting a split into the middle of NATO and Europe around Ukraine, I'd be thinking, what's that adage? Never interrupt your adversary when they make a mistake. I'll just let more of that happen, and then I'm dealing with a weaker opponent. So why act now?
Yeah, so I'm not sure peace is around the corner. So first rule of peacekeeping is you don't send peacekeepers unless there is a peace to keep. But let's assume there is a peace to keep and we make a contribution. It's very hard for me to see us providing something large. Basically, while I sort of agree that we should be focused on our near region, I kind of, in principle, like the shift to a more amphibious Australian army designed to operate in our region.
If we were looking after our near region security well, we could look at making an ADF contribution to Ukraine, but we just got caught absolutely flat-footed, asleep at the wheel by those Chinese warships, and it was an isolated event, but gosh, it exposed some weaknesses. So I think you're right, we should do that.
We don't have a lot to send, and if we cast our minds back to the war in Afghanistan, essentially we had a reinforced battalion type task force there in Tarin Kaut, and it essentially consumed the entire army to maintain that rotation there. So if we're talking serious boots on the ground, like an infantry battalion, I just cannot see that happening.
I don't think the Prime Minister is serious about this. I think he's using it to have something where he sounds stronger than the opposition on national security. But my prediction for this is we'll do a hootie on this one. So remember, the Americans asked us to make a contribution to the efforts to stop the Houthis shutting down global shipping.
Then we
sent
a frigate. We didn't send a frigate. No.
We sent about 5 staff officers to sit in our headquarters. And we keep talking about how grateful the Americans are for that. I think the Europeans should be prepared for a steely-eyed statement of resolve from Australia, which is in the form of 7 or 8 highly paid, high-ranked officers to coordinate them all.
Yes. Look, a flag is better than nothing. But yes, I don't think it's going to be large numbers on the
ground. And I can't help but say, I think you're right about, wouldn't it be good to have some amphibious capability here in Australia where we could move our army around if we needed to. One thing I would be doing if I was Prime Minister Albanese is getting the Defence Department to move those 49 Abrams tanks that we offered to Ukraine in October last year to Ukraine. Because I know at estimates, one of my favourite moments was having that defence official explain that you can't move tanks easily because they're very big and heavy items. So if I was Mr. Albanese, I'd be giving the Ukrainians that support rather than sending them some star-ranked officers.
We've got lots of star-ranked officers, though. One thing we have a lot of, Michael.
But they will come back.
Star-ranked officers.
They will come back. And I can see Defence making a case to create even more star-ranked officers to have a rotational ability in Ukraine. I can't help but one other little fact really caught my attention, which shows other countries are far more serious about a plan B for dealing with a more demanding or more unreliable America. So the stock value of Rheinmetall, the German big German defence company, has
building armoured vehicles in Australia.
Yes, it's overtaken the value of VW, because what's happened is American defence company valuations have plummeted because people may not buy their stuff. European defence companies' values have taken off for that same reason. And so Rheinmetall is now more valuable than VW, which of course is a story of America and China affecting Europe. China is eating Germany's automakers' lunch with their electric vehicles and push into Europe. And America is providing lunch for the German defense industry. So anyway, I think that's probably enough for our listeners, and it's certainly time to just check that recycling in the SAA bunker. It's getting a bit stale in here. So have a great time at the budget lockup.
I will. I always
look forward to hearing the new news that comes out of it, Marcus.
Okay, right. Thank you, Michael.